I'd like to welcome you all to this month's exciting installment of the Communicators at Cornell lunch program. We have a real treat in store for us today. By the way, I'm Kelly Spicer. I work for Alumni Affairs and Development. I run a program called Cornell on the Road, which is the faculty speaker series. I'm also a board member of EGAD, which is the steering committee of Communicators at Cornell. And this month, we are very pleased to present one of our top faculty members, Stephen Strogatz, who's the director of the Center for Applied Mathematics. Usually when academics are introduced, one would read a very long list of credentials. I'm actually going to skip that because we are not academics, and the list is very long indeed in Steve's case. So I'm just going to make a few points about Steve. One is that he is that rare breed, a scientist who can talk to regular people in a language that they can understand. And in fact, Steve has been widely recognized for this ability. In 2007, he received the Communications Award. It is a Lifetime Achievement Award for Science Communication. Among other notable achievements, Steve has been featured regularly on NPR. He filmed a series on chaos for the teaching company's Great Lecture Series. And last year, 2009, he published a book, a memoir, about his relationship with his high school math teacher called The Calculus of Friendship. Steve is here today because he is the first Cornell faculty member ever to have a column in the New York Times. This column, 13-week run, finished up recently, The Elements of Mathematics, and I think it's a very significant achievement. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Steve.
Thanks very much, Kelly. Does Bob Frank's column not count?
That's not Bob Frank.
No, it is. Of course it is. Yeah. Our Bob Frank in the Johnson School writes in the economic scene, I think it's called, once every four columns, right? He rotates with three other economists. But I don't mind the idea that I'm, you know, because I was the only one writing mine, so maybe... Bob and I play tennis, so maybe I've got, you know, match point on him here with this one. I don't think so, though. He usually beats me on the court. So, thank you very much for inviting me to this communicators event. It's very flattering to be thought of as a communicator. What I was hoping we could do is something really conversational. I don't really have a lecture as a lecturer prepared for you. What I wanted to do was talk to you about choices I had to make when writing this series for the Times, because it really was an issue of communication. And so I thought it might be fun if we compare the choices I made with the choices that you might have recommended instead. And I'm not doing that in any sort of tricky way. I honestly don't know if I made the right choices. And in a few cases, I know that I made the wrong choices. So it's sort of an interesting exercise, I hope, for us to discuss those. Oh, wow, the computer's already locked up. All right. Maybe you should sit close by.
Yes.
Thank you for letting me use a computer. All right, so what we have here is a page on the Times using Red Rover where the 15 columns are listed here. By the way, some of the illustrations... Actually, nearly all the illustrations are done by a person in town, Margaret Nelson, who some of you may know. Margie is an artist and scientific illustrator. And so I want to give a big shout out to her because her very whimsical art did help, I think, make the whole thing look more accessible. So probably I should start first with the backstory. How did I come to be asked to write this series? A few years ago, when I had a popular science book called Sync, my agent contacted the op-ed page editor of the New York Times, David Shipley, and I think he does that routinely with all his writers, and said, you know, would you consider taking an op-ed from this client of mine? So I submitted something, and it got published. And as the years have gone by, I've written a few op-eds, and I've come to know this editor, David Shipley. So he said to me sometime in the fall, last year, if you're in the city, let's have lunch. you know, and I thought he's kidding. But he said, no, I mean it. Because I had had breakfast with him one other time, and we had pretty good chemistry, and we have kids about the same age. And so, I took him at his word, and I said, okay, I'm coming. You want to have lunch? He said, yes, let's meet at the Oyster Bar at Grand Central Station, which sounded like a very literary, you know, that's what you would do with the editor for the Times, right? So I'd never heard of the Oyster Bar at Grand Central, but I found it, and we sat down, and he said, would you ever have time to write a series for us? And it happened that both my courses were in the fall. Through some glitch of scheduling, I taught my whole teaching load in the fall, and so I had no courses to teach this spring. And I said, how about, in the spring, I think I would have time. And he said, that's great, let's do it. Now, I want it to be about math, but do you have any ideas for how you would structure it? So now I come to the first place for you to make suggestions. Suppose you're me having a conversation with the editor, and if you don't want it to be math, substitute whatever, if you're a philosopher or someone interested in agriculture or whatever, think about, you have the opportunity to talk to, or to write, to the readers of the Times about some discipline in a way that's going to be interesting, hopefully, to the readers of the Times. So how would you do it? So why don't I mean it as a serious question. Why don't we talk about that? Does anyone have suggestions? I mean, if you've read these columns or these pieces, you may already know what choice I made. But if you haven't, or even if you have, just think, what would be the best thing to do? I mean, I can give you some choices if you want, but maybe you can suggest possibilities. Yeah, ask him what the audience is like.
Ask him a bunch of questions about what are the most popular styles of writing, articles get the most.
That's interesting. I see. So you could almost ask for like market information or demo. That is, what tends to work and what tends not to work in his experience. By the way, this invitation was for the online part of the Times, NewYorkTimes.com. So I was told that this would be I wouldn't have to worry about space the same way you would in the print edition. So he was estimating 1,000 to 1,500 words for each piece, whereas normally in the print section it would be like between 500 and 1,000. Yes?
I really like James Surowiecki's economics column that he does for The New Yorker.
And what he does, Jim Surowiecki you're talking about?
Yeah. Yep. He does an economics
That's right.
page every now and again. And he takes like a current, really difficult idea that's sort of confusing people and tries to sort of shed some light on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes it very readable.
So the strategy that you're mentioning there is to look at something. You mentioned the word current. That is, there something that's in the news that's on people's mind, some topical, confusing aspect of economics or finance, and then he...
He explains it. He says, maybe it's not what you think. Maybe it's uh-huh. something
Right, right. And certainly there's lots of math in the news, although maybe it's hidden. People don't recognize that these are fundamentally, like say with climate change, there are statistical issues, there's mathematical modeling issues about prediction, or about the oil spill, or you could find math in the news easily. And so one possible way to do these columns would be math in everyday life as it's happening today. And one of us at lunch suggested that. Yes.
I was thinking about really basic principles in math that all of us at least touch on in our schooling. So like the Pythagorean theorem, like I read the piece that you did about that.
Uh-huh.
So something that people might be able to say, oh, I remember that from school, and now you get to tell a story about it that they might not.
Yes. So that's another strategy, would be not topical. Go timeless. Math has been around for thousands of years, and talk about the classic things like the Pythagorean theorem, or all the things that we all had in school, starting from arithmetic and preschool topics, all the way to what is for many people the last math course they took, calculus, or in some cases algebra or geometry. So the other of us at the table said, how about starting with the beginning and just walk through the whole curriculum as far as you can. Yes.
So maybe something neither of you said.
Yes.
How about tying it to what children learn in elementary school? So something that if you have a child, you can take home and you can engage your family with, or your children who have not been reading in your class.
Yes. Right, that
appeared to be smarter.
It's a Hod makes a very good point that, I mean, for many people other than, say, people in technical fields, the only time they're using math anymore, aside from, you know, making change or calculating the tip, is that because their kids are taking math and they have to help the kid with homework. So how about something kid or family centered? That could be very valuable too. Yes, excuse me? Oh, I got to keep touching the pad. Just do something to keep it alive. Okay. Well, do you think that was enough? All right. Yes, John?
Martin Gardner's column in Scientific American, mm-hmm. I think, was a real role model for bringing math to the general public.
Mm-hmm.
Almost universal.
Yep.
And so something that focused upon puzzles or curiosities.
Excuse me. Yeah, so John makes the point that some of you, or maybe many of you, will know of Martin Gardner, who was the math columnist for Scientific American. And his approach was to actually get people to do math, as opposed to appreciate math or read about math, to engage with the most fundamental activity there is in math, which is to solve puzzles. That is, it's an active enterprise. It's not some passive thing. And so we've just got four ideas out there, right? There's the children-centered one, the puzzle-solving one, math in the news, and the concepts of math. And so you can probably guess, or maybe not, actually. Which one of us at the table do you think said, do math in the news? Me or him? The editor? Is that obvious that it was the editor? No, that was not him. That was me. No, the editor said, I want you to just start at preschool. And I was shocked at that, really shocked, because you can see the advantages and disadvantages of the two choices. The topical choice has the great advantage that it's topical and it's sort of interesting and exciting, but it's got the disadvantage that it's potentially disorganized. One week to the next, there's no particular theme. The other approach, where you're grinding through the curriculum, is very organized. We've all gone through that, so we know what's coming next. But it's pedantic, and it seems like, you know, man, I had to do this once. You're making me do it again. So, you know, I was really surprised that he would suggest that. And I said, I can't, that seems so tiring and pedantic for the reader. He said, no, you'll make it, you know, really fun. And because his point was that a lot of us, especially the readers of the Times, a lot of these people are very, of course, they're very smart, well-educated readers, but they lost it somewhere in their math education. They missed something. And all of us have, just about, unless we became professional mathematicians, and even in that case, it might still be true, we all hit the wall somewhere where we couldn't understand the next thing in math, and then that was it. And for a lot of us, there's a kind of shame that goes with that, or embarrassment. I mean, there's actual emotional, you remember this feeling. I mean, we all had it, where you couldn't get something in math. So there was that whole psychological dimension of this proposition. If I'm going to write about math, I'm taking people back to, you know, like, they're going to have flashbacks to to some unpleasant experience. But that also gives a chance, you know, there's a real opportunity there too, which is maybe you can help people get over whatever horrible traumatic experience they had, and they can see how beautiful math is, or what we mean when we say it's elegant. Anyway, so he said, no, that's what I want you to do, and I'm the editor, and are you willing to do that? I said, yes. And actually, I was thrilled to do it, because that comes so easily. I mean, to have to read the news and figure out what to say about global warming and all the snarky politics of that, that's dreadful. I mean, the Pythagorean theorem, who's going to argue about that? You know? So I thought this was, especially because it's going to be on the web, and that's a whole dimension of this that I had never faced. Active, first of all, people reading my stuff, that doesn't happen normally. I'm serious. I mean, if you write an academic paper, there's going to be maybe literally 10 or 20 people who will read it carefully in the world. Seriously, I mean, we're all used to that. You ship off a paper, it goes into the black hole, there are a few people who might read it that are in your field. But this is now gonna have hundreds of thousands of people potentially reading it. And so I wasn't used to that. And more than that, they talk back, right? On the web, they're writing comments. And that was a daunting thing. Okay, so anyway, that was the first choice then, the structure. And so the answer was a straightforward march through the curriculum. All right, next, the question of the audience, which you raised. And again, you can think of four, at least, types of audience for such a thing. You could, like John mentions, the puzzle solvers. You could write for math buffs. That is, say, realistically, nobody's going to read this who doesn't already like math, and let's just write for them, like Martin Gardner did. Or you could say, no, the chance here is to write for everybody and aim it at the, I don't want to say lowest common denominator, but, you know, people who think they don't like math, try to suck them in. You could write for students and their parents, or, you know, very cynically just say, no, we know that nobody's interested in math except professional scientists and mathematicians, so let them have their day in the New York Times and just write to them. That might be a realistic attitude, actually. Here, you already know what choice I made. I tried to write for everybody. Okay. And I think that was the right choice, because there are plenty of other places writing for those other audiences. But people did ask, for instance, why no puzzles? You know, I really miss puzzles. I want puzzles. And I never really ask any puzzles. Okay, now, what about the emphasis? So here, that is, what should it really be about, given that it's going to be about the curriculum? Starting with, say, numbers. And then, I mean, try to remember your math education. What is math in terms of the way that it was taught? That is, you did arithmetic, you learned about adding and subtracting and all that. Then at some point you got into harder stuff because division is hard, like fractions, decimals, percentages. Those are all about division. And then it gets symbolic. Then there's X's and Y's, it's algebra, and then geometry, and now shapes, and visualization, and then proof, right? That's where proof starts to enter in geometry, logical reasoning. It could enter anywhere. It could enter with numbers, but it never does. And then finally there's calculus, and things start moving around. It's calculus about change and motion. So, and then there's all that murky stuff that's after calculus that only a few people ever study. And I wanted to show some of that too. So what should be the emphasis? Should it be about the ideas themselves? That would be one way to go. That would be very disembodied. I mean, a lot of people say that for popularization, it should have blood. It should be about people. So I could write about the great mathematicians and their struggles. You know, like, because all these things are about struggles and people wanting to do something. What else? I mean, maybe you can suggest. If it's not about ideas or about people, but it's still about math, what could it be about? Or does that exhaust it?
Famous problems,
right? That's a very natural one for math, that the subject is almost defined by its unsolved problems. Because, you know, if you focused on the great, that is, they're like the highest peaks in the mountain range or the unclimbed Everests of the subject. So if you described this Everest and said, why is it interesting? Why do people want to climb it? How far have they gotten up? And where did they get stuck and why? That would make a very interesting series, I think. Just do it that way. About the quest. I mean, it makes the subject heroic sounding. Our one chance to be. Any other thought? Yes?
It could be you applying it. There's principles, and this is how it's reflected in your everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, making it, keeping it real. Right, that's a side of math that often doesn't come out in most people's education, the applied end. We a lot of us learned about numbers and shapes and things, but the connection to reality, and especially to our everyday lives, not just science, for many people is kind of mysterious. So that would be a welcome thing. Well, anyway, my own choice was ideas. And that wasn't an easy choice because I like the stories about people. And I'd hardly told any. Now, I don't know, so I should not assume that everyone here has read all 15 columns. I think that would be a false assumption. But I would like you to just tell me honestly, and don't feel bad if you've read none of them, are there some people here who, this is the first time you're hearing about this? You have, yes, okay, so like half the people don't even know what we're talking about. Are there some people here who read several of the columns? So, yes, okay. So then it seems to be about half and half. Let me give you a flavor of what they're like if you haven't seen them. And so here's the first one. And this is where I tried to explain what I was doing and also convey a tone. That's the next choice, of course. What's the tone? Now, maybe before I open it, I guess I could open it, but then you'll start reading it. Before I show you this one, there are people who are very successful at math popularization, and they each have their own voice, naturally. They're different people. So one guy that you know is out there is named John Allen Paulos. And some of you may know him. He's a professor at Temple. He wrote a book some years ago called Enumeracy, which was very big. I mean, it was a big bestseller. And Enumeracy took the point of view that the American public is enumerate. That's supposed to mean like illiterate. That they don't know the most bit. And that was, I think, around the time of the book, was it called Cultural Illiteracy or something like that? And there was the closing of the American mind. There was a lot of self-flagellating. The public was eating up anything that told them how stupid they were or how illiterate they were. And so if you went in there and say, not only illiterate and have a closed mind, but you don't know numbers, they want to hear it. And that was the tone of those pieces. And to me, when I read John Allen Paulos, I always feel like I'm a bad person. You know, I'm being scolded for not knowing this or not reasoning properly about that or being fooled by conditional probability. So it's an eat your vegetables tone, that you're going to read this because it's good for you and because, you know, you're a slug. And for some people, that's motivating. They want to be less of a slug, so they'll read it. I obviously don't like that approach. But it works pretty well in his hands. Now, another approach is to say, you're not the slug, it's your teacher who's the slug. Okay, that is, you can make a lot of hay by beating up the American educational system. That you're not the problem, you went to school in America, that's the problem. And so your teachers are idiots, the curriculum is stupid, there's a lot of rote memorization, you've heard or read things like this, right? Those are also quite popular. And so, like recently, there was a book by a mathematician and teacher named Paul Lockhart called A Mathematician's Lament, which is also a very nice book. I mean, I'm not criticizing. These are just different choices of voice. And I like his book a lot. And so he beats up the math curriculum and says, the problem with math as it's taught is that we're not teaching math. We're teaching all this mechanical nonsense, you know, but not the ideas of math. And no wonder people get turned off. If we would actually teach math, students would like it. So, and he shows how to do it. This book just came out a year or two ago. It's pretty good. I mentioned it prominently in my first two columns. But not that negative side. Not the your teachers are bad. I emphasize the positive side, the beautiful ways that he has thought of to get students exposed to the ideas. Instead, okay, so what voice did I want? Naturally, my own voice. Which is that I'm your friend, and I want to share something with you that I love, and I want you to love it. Or at least I want you to understand why I love it. That is, it's truly about friends. And so I want to talk to my reader the same way I would talk to my friend. I'm not going to condescend, because that person won't be your friend very long if you talk. And I actually thought of a particular friend. So this is how I began the first article. Let's see if I can get that to work. So I don't know if that's going to be, probably you can't read that from back there, but I'll just read you the first few words. Well, I'm having all kinds of mouse trouble. Okay, let's see. All right. So here's how it begins. I have a friend who gets a tremendous kick out of science, even though he's an artist. Some people actually didn't like that first sentence. Why wouldn't an artist like science? You know, that was probably a bad sentence, actually. What do you mean, even though? And he's an artist. Like, there's, okay, anyway, that wasn't, there's a deadline. Each week you have to write something. So, and I did not have them in the can. There were not like, you know, I had stockpiled five of them. No, I was writing them. I've never had to write like that. It was a new experience. So I would maybe tweak some of the wording now, but okay. I have a friend who gets a tremendous kick out of science, even though he's an artist. Whenever we get together, all he wants to do is chat about the latest thing in evolution or quantum mechanics. But when it comes to math, he feels at sea, and it saddens him. The strange symbols keep him out. He says he doesn't even know how to pronounce them. In fact, his alienation runs a lot deeper. He's not sure what mathematicians do all day, or what they mean when they say a proof is elegant. Sometimes we joke that I should just sit him down and teach him everything, starting with 1 plus 1 equals 2 and going as far as we can. Crazy as it sounds, over the next several weeks, I'm going to try to do something close to that. I'll be writing about the elements of mathematics from preschool to grad school for anyone out there who'd like to have a second chance at the subject, but this time from an adult perspective. It's not intended to be remedial. The goal is to give you a better feeling for what math is all about and why it's so enthralling to those who get it. So let's begin with preschool. And then I have a little video here from Sesame Street. Now, this is the beauty of the web, of course, that you can show videos. Or there's all, I had thought I'm on this kind of second-rate patch of real estate. You know, I'm on the web, nobody's gonna see it. It's not the print edition, that's much more prestigious. So at first I thought this isn't so good to be on the web, but then we had Carl Zimmer here, who's one of their science writers and blogger, and he was giving a talk for Darwin Day. Actually, it was in the fall, it was the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin. But anyway, Carl Zimmer was here, and I asked him some questions about, you know, what about blogging and how do you do it, and he told me, don't think like that. It's very nice on the web, and you can actually use it. It's a more powerful medium. You can show color, you can go over on length, you can make links to all kinds of interesting things. So try to exploit the power of the web. Don't just feel like it's print but inferior. And so I often, for each piece, tried to think what video or what cool visual can I put in there. Anyway, so before I show this little video, you get the point. I'm really thinking about this friend of mine who is a smart person but doesn't know math. And it's a real person. It's Alan Alda, the actor. So you may have seen his TV show, Scientific American Frontiers. He loves science. He really does. And that's how we met. He once wrote to me because he had some science question. And he said, could I come talk to you about it? And I thought, are you kidding? And that really happened. And he came. I was teaching at MIT at the time. And we had a lunch together. And we're sitting in the MIT cafeteria at Walker Memorial, and, you know, of course, people are looking, and they're making excuses to come talk to me about one thing or another, and then some student starts hovering around the table and finally comes over and says, excuse me, and we both look up, and he said, aren't you Professor Strogatz? This is a true story. So anyway, yeah, I've gotten to know Alan Alda, and we've stayed friends all these years. He has three daughters who are about the same age as me and my wife. There's a very natural, I don't know, the roles work very well. So anyway, when I say I have a friend who doesn't know math but who wants to talk about science, and he wishes he could understand something about math, each week I would write, when I felt the little writer's block creeping in, dear Alan, let me tell you about the Pythagorean theorem. And then I just try to write to him in my voice that I use with him. So that's the voice you're seeing here. And the other thing I think that's notable about this is the psychological gambit of saying that you are like my friend, meaning you are a very smart person. You are not a person with math phobia, or maybe you are, but you want to learn math, don't you? You want to know how to pronounce those strange symbols. And that is, it's not eat your vegetables time. It's I'm going to help you do what you want to do, but you're embarrassed that you haven't been. So this phrase, a second chance at math, turned out to really resonate. And if you look down below, well, I won't go, I'm not going to risk scrolling. There are about 500 comments to this first article. That's a lot for the Times when they, you know, it was the most I ever got in the 15 pieces. So 500 people wrote in, and what was amazing to me was the lack of the usual sound of web talk. Like, people weren't mean. They were saying, what the overriding reaction was gratitude. People were saying, thank you so much, and thank you to the New York Times for running a series about math. So that was very encouraging. And anyway, now, as far as preschool, just to give a flavor of the kind of thing I wanted to show, this is to explain what numbers are. Now, you might think you know what numbers are because you remember, like if you're teaching a kid, you'd think of numbers as a part of a song, right? You go one, two, three. It's like a verbal thing that they learn, just like they learn ABC, they learn one, two, three. It's just a verbal, it doesn't particularly mean, you know, you try to teach them, it's about their fingers, but it takes the kid several years to learn what you're really doing with this game of singing the numbers, what the numbers refer to. So there's actually quite a deep thing that is inherent in the idea of number. And to me, the clearest exposition of this was in this Sesame Street video that we used to watch with our kids when they were very little. So it's from you can buy the DVD, or VHS tape. It's called 1, 2, 3, Count With Me. And let's see if I can get this to work. Now, you got the audio under control, Bert. All right, here we go. Let's see if that will work.
The phone. Oh. I get it.
Can you hear anything?
Man,
you want me to stand closer? Is this, am I wasting your time?
A fish.
I could try doing the sound on the computer. You want to control your computer. Maybe I'll start that over. But we're not plugged into that. I don't think so.
It's already as loud.
You are?
We're hearing it.
Oh, okay, let's try again. It's very charming, this idea that instead of saying fish, 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 you can just say six fish. And what I especially like is when Humphrey, the furry, the pink-faced guy, says, does it work with spark plugs and cinnamon rolls? I mean, that is exactly what numbers are about. I mean, in math, we would say numbers are equivalence classes. That is the thing that six spark plugs have in common with six cinnamon rolls and six fish is the quintessential idea of six. They're equivalent in that they have the same number of elements in the set. It doesn't matter what the thing. Anyway, the point is that that they're really getting at what numbers are in this. I just think it's the best. So, all right. That was the first one. Oh, I don't want to show that again. No, no, no. Stop, stop. No, okay. Good. Do you want to ask anything at this point, or should I just keep rambling along? Yes?
I have like an issue with copyright using Sesame.
Oh, good, yes.
And also related was the having your own artist.
Yes.
Sort of two issues with bringing in your own sort of, you know, accessories to your comm.
Uh-huh.
You have to do that.
Yeah. Oh, good. These are good questions. Okay, first on the copyright issue, that's absolutely something that Times needs to care about and does care about. So I would have to tell them as far in advance as I could that I wanted to use something like, say, this clip from Sesame Street, which, in fact, I didn't have. I had the VHS tape, but I said, is there any way we could get this? And they then say, we'll work on it. They have a department that deals with that kind of thing, with rights. And often it would go to the right up to the deadline. They'd say, we either do or don't have the rights to show a certain thing. And so I would always write the piece under the assumption I don't have it. And so I would write as vividly as I could, a pink-faced, furry gentleman named Humphrey is talking to. And so sometimes the column might not read so well because you're reading exactly what you're seeing, but it's for that reason. So they took care of the rights, and sometimes they either they would get them or they didn't. In this case, the Sesame Street people are there in New York City, and they were very cooperative, and they even made the little clip and sent it over. There was another time, though, when I showed a clip from the TV show Moonlighting. You may remember it. Let me show you this one. It's fun. This was about a topic that a lot of us remember without that much fondness. And it was in this article called Power Tools. Let me just show you. It's only 10 seconds long. I'll explain about that in a second, why. Or maybe even less than 10 there. Do you remember this show? Should we make it a little darker? Just for this, or is that going to mess you up?
Yeah.
But does it mess you up, Eric?
No.
So, all right. Sorry, just for the audience here. So there's Bruce Willis when he had hair, and Sybil Shepherd in her big comeback in this show. And I had remembered all these years that there was this great, what I thought was a great joke in Moonlighting that had math significance. So here it goes.
Boy, is this going to be a fun place to work until they find that guy?
Who are you picking any exact then?
Beats me. But you know what I don't understand?
Logarithms. What? Do you understood those?
So I don't know if you could all hear that, but so they're talking to, they're in the coroner's office, and they're talking to the coroner's assistant about some murder victim, and they're asking him who he thinks did the crime, and he says, I don't know, or Bruce Willis says, who are you picking? And then, who was it who says, but you know what, I don't know? Oh, you're right, so then the coroner says, but you know what, I don't understand, and he says, logarithms? And then Maddie looks at him. What, you understood those? So anyway, this was in a column about logarithms. But maybe you can see that that's why I had to resort to that technique again. Beats me, says the assistant, you know what, I don't understand, to which David replies, logarithms. Okay, so it's all there. Now in this case, we didn't get permission. It turns out that to use anything from Moonlighting, you have to get permission from Bruce Willis and Sybil Shepherd themselves, and from the producers, and from ABC or whoever. And they all have to answer quickly enough so that, you know, the thing can run. And they didn't answer. So the lawyers at the New York Times said, if you can cut it down as short as possible, we'll say it's fair use and we think we can get away with it. Or they don't use that kind of language. But, you know, they said, they said you can, yes, it's allowed as long as it's short enough. And so we just ran it, and that was it, and we haven't been, or not me, I mean, the Times hasn't been sued yet. I think it's okay. Now, you also asked about using my own artist. So that was an issue because I wanted to possibly show complicated equations, or at least have the option if I needed to. And I wanted a lot of back and forth with the artist about the images. And so I thought I could use their in-house art, but then it became pretty clear in talking to them that they weren't equipped. It wouldn't be interactive enough, and it would be scary. So, and I've worked a lot with Margie Nelson and knew that she was great. And so I just paid her out of my own pocket, except not really out of my own pocket, because as a professor, I have different slush funds to pay for things that are legitimate educational expenses. So I paid her out of a slush fund. But it was a really good choice to do it that way. Why did you ask about that? Yes.
Topic,
yes.
And she didn't see the artwork until the day it appeared.
Yeah.
So just for you to have some control in advance of what the accompanying art was going to be. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting, because I wonder if there's some difference between the print version and the web version. The few times I've done print op-eds, they don't let me see the art, and they don't let me see the title. They have their own headline people. So they make the headline, they make the art, and then it's a big surprise to me. And I've been unhappy with some of the titles and art that they've done. So that's, your friend is not alone in that. But on the web, they let me pick the headline and do my own art. And I don't know if it's because it's the web or what. So, okay, yeah, I mentioned equations. That's, of course, a potential problem. There's something that is known in publishing circles that there's this folklore that every equation you have in your book will reduce the sales by a factor of 10. And so, you know, if you want to have like many equations, if you remember in homeopathy, they talk about diluting the active ingredient down so that there's like no molecules of the stuff in the... So I wanted to show equations, possibly, but I knew that a lot of people have bad reactions to them, including Alan Alda always says he doesn't like these symbols. Because he can't say them. He can't, even when he's reading them in his head, he doesn't know what to say. So I was very reluctant to use them, and I did use very, very few. Just ones that I thought might be familiar from high school. Like if I'm showing the Pythagorean theorem, I might write a squared plus b squared equals c squared. People kind of remember that. Some people do. My wife actually was a good barometer for these. She did math through high school, but never really knew what she was doing, she says. And so if she could understand stuff, it seemed appropriate. Yes?
Were you trying to teach with these artists? Were you thinking about teaching?
I absolutely am trying to teach with these. Yeah, here I'm doing it the way I really want to do it, which is I want it to be lighthearted, but I haven't actually conveyed this with what I'm saying yet. I do want to teach honest-to-God math. Like I did show the Pythagorean theorem with a proof. In fact, two proofs. And tried to compare the two. This proof is, I claim, nicer than this other proof. And I explain what that means. There's a whole aesthetic dimension to math, which comes as a surprise to many people. They think it's about right and wrong. You know, they say math is very authoritarian. There's just a right answer, a wrong answer. That's not true at all. There are many ways of having a right answer, and some are better than others. And also, there's even more ways of having a wrong answer. And some of them can be brilliant, by the way. I mean, a wrong answer can be brilliant for its ingenuity. It just happens to go wrong. But, yes?
Is math like language? Like, if I start teaching my 4-year-old algebra now, will they learn it?
Oh, that's an interesting idea. The question is math like language, that if you started a young child, just as they're good at picking up languages, would they pick up math that much faster while they've got a window? I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, I have a reaction. I can tell you why I don't think so, but yes, do you want to disagree?
The kids do early on decide that they don't like math or not good at it.
Yeah.
That you can prevent.
That you can, yeah, right. You can inflict your own hang-ups on your kid very easily. That could happen. Your fear of math, your hatred of math, your thought that this is useless, I never used the quadratic formula, you don't need to really learn it. You know, that kind of thing you can do. But the reason I react no to your question is that I don't think the analogy of math with a language is really right. Yes, it has aspects of a language, but I would say it's one of the... What's so special about it is that it's almost everything you can think of. It's a language, it's a game, it's a sport, it's a science, it's an art. I mean, it has all those dimensions to it. And so it's a culture. So what I'm trying to do is show this many-faceted nature of math, the artistic side, the language side, and to harp on it as being one thing only. Like in school, you're taught it's to calculate, it's to balance your checkbook, it's to do spreadsheets. You know, that's the most dry version of what it's about, the idea that it's creative or that it's living, you know, that it's not all created by Euclid and those people 2,000 years ago. That often doesn't come across. So, Oh, what time would you like me to stop? Tomorrow. should we end at 1 or 1:15?
1:15 if people can stay and ask some questions.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any particular destination here. I was just going to keep asking you questions about what you would do, you know, should. But I'm happy to take whatever questions you want to ask. Yes?
So I have a question that relates to how to teach math better. I know that because of standardized testing and all these other factors, that teachers almost sort of plow through a large amount of material over the course of the semester. Now, what you did here was, it's very simple, because mm-hmm. you take one idea at a time. So what would you say about the idea of taking one concept at a time and teaching it until you're absolutely sure that the students...
I like that. I do like that. I think that's a big part of what we do wrong at the moment, is that this feeling of needing to cover the material. You always hear about this word cover. We've got so much to cover. I can't take that question. I need to, you know, as one, there's a maybe apocryphal story, the teacher says to the student, I'm here to teach, not answer questions. You know, that we have to keep going. And I've also heard it said, our goal shouldn't be to cover the material, it should be to uncover it. You know, and then I sometimes think of the word cover too, like the in music, there's a concept of covering. They'll say, that's James Taylor's cover of Carole King's You've Got a Friend. Okay, that's his take on it. And I sort of thought what I was trying to do in these columns was cover math in the James Taylor sense. That I want to give my cover of the Pythagorean theorem or of pi r squared for the area of a circle. This is what it's like for me. And so that's what these are. And each column is a cover of one greatest hit of math. And that's all. And but I felt it was important to show the reasoning. So each, that is, so many things are just presented as dogma. Or the student never remembers why is the area pi r squared. So maybe I'll show you that one, in case you hadn't seen this. It's such a pretty argument that, and you know, this is one reason it's so nice to work here. I didn't know this argument. One of my students showed it to me. His name is Tim Novikoff, and he was a teacher at Stuyvesant High School in New York before he entered our PhD program. And this is from him. Now, this is actually not from him. This is an ancient argument that, I don't know, may go back to Babylonian times or something. But it was to try to understand the area of a circle through a picture. Is this not coming up? Where am I? It's working. What's it working on? I don't know. Where is it? I'm going to try going up there. Okay. Yeah, so this column, I'm trying to explain the idea of what limits are. And limits bring in the idea of infinity. You may have heard of limits if you took calculus. But I wanted to show visually what limits are about and why they're such a great idea. And so, okay, I'm reminding people what a circle is. That's what the circumference is, the part, you know, the distance around, the diameter is the distance across. And now, to understand the area of a circle, this ancient argument says, chop it up into pieces. And so there are the four pieces, and then rearrange them into this funny scalloped shape. Now, you might wonder, what, that doesn't seem helpful. That's right, because this is a very ingenious argument. This is a really brilliant thing someone thought of. So yes, at the moment, it doesn't look promising. We've made some weird duck shape or some scalloped shape by moving those four pieces around. But I just want to point out two things about those four pieces. That the bottom, if I don't know if you can see it, the small lettering, it says pi r. It's half the circumference is the length of that bottom because half the circle is there, those two pieces of the four. And on the top, if you followed along, it would be another pi r, half the circumference again, and then that side has a length r. Now, again, that doesn't seem helpful in figuring out the area, but it is if you take it to the limit. If instead of four pieces, you try more pieces. That is, So here I've got Margie drawing different colors. Okay, so she now makes 8 colors and rearranges them like so. And now you can sort of see that the shape is looking better, right? It doesn't look quite so weird. In fact, the curvy parts on the bottom are starting to look straighter, and the side is starting to stand up more vertical. And then if I go a little bit more with all those pieces and rearrange, can you see it's trying to become a rectangle? And so if you take infinitely many pieces, whatever that means, that's where it's not a rigorous argument, but it's the right idea. If you take infinitely many pieces, you get that rectangle shown at the bottom, which has a pi r along the bottom, half the circumference, and r of the top. And we know what the area of a rectangle is. It's that length times that length, so it's pi r times r. That's pi r squared. So that column was devoted to showing that argument. And this was one of the most popular columns for some reason, because I think a lot of people, including my wife, said, that is illuminating. That's a moment of aha. I got that now. I never got that before. And I get it. Then it's pretty. It's actually very pretty. And it's easy. How come no one showed me that before? Well, of course, there's many reasons. First of all, they may have and you forgot. Or a lot of mathematicians don't like this argument because there's some hand waving when you say, take it to the limit of going to infinity. That's hard to justify properly. So if your only concern is being absolutely strictly correct, which some of us have been brainwashed, that's what is good about math, you know, rigorous proof, you won't show that argument. But then you're a bad teacher, because you should show that argument. That argument is essentially right, and it conveys so much intuition. And also, the parts of it that aren't right raise good questions, like how can we make it right? What do we need to do to make infinity rigorous? That's the opening the door to a whole branch of math. That's what calculus is about, how to tame infinity so that it actually makes sense. And so by dusting that under the carpet, you're leaving out the whole history of the subject and, you know, pretending that things are easier than they are. Anyway, so that was a very popular one. I think maybe I'll end. I said I learned some things to do and also some things that I did wrong. Why don't I tell you one thing I did wrong, which if I could summarize it in a principle, and I'm not sure this is right, but because I haven't actually read all the comments. There were hundreds of comments for each column, actually. And my own personality is such that when I read the comments, I get very inhibited and defensive. And, you know, because some people want to pick a fight, or they are smarter than me, or they have something I overlooked. And it makes me want to argue with them. And also, it makes me feel like, oh, darn it, I did something wrong. And then I can't write the next column, because I'm going to get in an obsessive loop trying to figure out how to answer that person. And so I know that about myself and decided I'm not reading any comments. I'm just going to keep writing. But my wife would read the comments. And she would never tell me the bad ones. She would tell me the good ones. And that worked pretty well. But I should actually read some of the negative comments. So I know for a fact that one of the columns had very few comments, and it wasn't very well emailed. It was one of the least emailed. And I thought it was a really interesting column, but it violated what I now think is a good principle, which is that if you're writing about math or maybe any other hard thing for a general audience, you can be unfamiliar. You could pick an unfamiliar topic or an abstract topic, but not both. That is, the reader can handle something that's abstract, like this, about the area of a circle. You know, that's not about anything practical, particularly. But it's familiar. Everyone's gone through pi r squared. So it's pure math, but it is familiar. Or you can do something that's unfamiliar, as long as it's very, very visual and down to earth. But if you try to do both, you might get in trouble. And I did do that in at least one column. And this was because I was trying to build something around the strength of the web. It was this one, think globally. After doing ordinary geometry, the Pythagorean theorem, I thought I would show people some modern geometry in what's called differential geometry. This was probably a bad choice, especially where it was positioned in the series. It was sort of too early in the series. Like, maybe at the end you could get away with that, but it was a shock to have something so unfamiliar so early. And so, in particular, the reason I wanted to show it was because one of my colleagues told me of a certain video that I thought would be really fun for people to see, but it turned out it wasn't so fun. Okay, so I was trying to show something about the surface of the Earth, and then, you know, the Earth is not the only conceivable surface of interest. So you can have, you could imagine planets shaped like this funny, oh gee, can you see that? Could you put the light out for a sec? This is an Earth shaped like a sort of two bagels stuck together, a double hole, sort of pretzel shape, a double hole donut. And then I wanted to illustrate what it means, what's the analog of a straight line? So there was this video to show if you're driving on a surface like this, is this gonna work? It just says loading video. I don't know what that's, okay. I may not get to show that. But it's a, all right, let's have the lights back on. It was a video of an imaginary motorcycle rider driving on that funny surface with the two holes, trying to always go on in a straight line, whatever that means, on this curved surface. And I'm trying to get across the idea that a straight line is the shortest distance between two points, but on a curved surface, your idea of a straight line has to change, because it's going to curve with the surface, just like the shortest path from here to Rome follows a curved arc, but it's because the Earth is curving. But you don't do any additional curving, okay? Like you don't fly down towards Cape Horn or something. You try to go as straight as you can on a curved surface. That's the concept I was trying to get across. And this motorcycle thing would have done that, but it turned out it was a real dud, and I did read one comment which said, the series has jumped the shark. Do you know what that means?
Oh, yeah.
I did not know what that meant. I heard the phrase and didn't know. Who knows where it comes from?
What
jumped the shark. Okay, so you can look that up on Wikipedia or any other place. Young people, or young people younger than me anyway, know it. You want to explain who said Happy Days?
It's an episode of Happy Days where they're on vacation and Fonzie jumps over a shark with a surfboard, and that's the point of a show or literature or anything where people are like, oh, I've had it. It's just so beyond ridiculous now. It's jumped the shark. It's no longer viable.
Exactly. It's where something that had been entertaining and successful needs to refresh itself and try something new to go not be stale, and it does something so absurd like jumping the shark.
I think it was wearing his leather jacket.
Yeah, yeah. So there I was told, my series already in like column 6 or 7 had jumped the shark halfway through, and that was very worrisome that some readers were thinking that. But I managed to recover. I kept it simpler after that. All right, I see people have other engagements now, so maybe it's time to just say thanks for your attention. And
thank you. If anyone wants
to stick around, I'm happy to talk some more.